Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with stories that really matter. And coming up on the program, Budget 2025, now the talking begins. Why smartphone sales are down in South Africa, working out the true value of water and the value of real work tech experience for young graduates. It's Thursday, the 13th of March. Now, there's absolutely no doubt the 2025 budget is a balancing act between economic prudence and also pressing social needs. With a VAT hike, infrastructure investments and efforts to stabilize debt, the speech offering some bold decisions with significant implications for businesses and individuals. So let's discuss the speech and what the numbers mean for South Africans. Head of bonds at Prescient is Reeza Ishmael. Reeza, a very warm welcome to you. So I guess the VAT increase is the big talking point, half a percentage point over 2 years. The DA is not going to support this budget. I guess we are back in uncharted territory in many respects.
Yeah, I think the most contentious issue has indeed been the VAT question. And I think it's a lot more of a tapered down suggestion than what had originally been tabled. So basically, we get a 0.5% increase in the next two fiscal windows and in the next 2 years. So within the next 2 years, VAT increases from 15% to 16%. Now, obviously, the question that's on everybody's lips is now why they're opting for VAT, right? And I would just comment right up front that I would say that the minister's actually got quite limited a number of levers. There's only a finite number of levers that he can pull. And if we were to look at something like personal income taxes or even corporate taxes, then what we do know from sort of the empirical evidence is that have not had been sort of viable alternatives. For example, what we do know is if personal taxes are increased, then those that are a little bit more financially mobile, they simply move away to more favorable tax jurisdictions. And the same thing goes for companies. They simply look for more clever and efficient ways of not tax evasion, but tax avoidance. So you have decreasing returns to scale the more you actually increase sort of personal and corporate taxes. And actually VAT, being much more broad-based and affecting every stage of the supply chain is a lot harder to evade as such and affects a little bit of a wider net. So not an easy decision, but something that certainly will be felt by all segments of the financial spectrum.
I mean, there is zero rating on certain goods, but the reality of the situation is that it will, as you say, impact ordinary South Africans, and we're going to have to bite the bullet twice.
That is true. Now, I mean, what they have tried to do to sort of protect your sort of lower income segments is that they have increased, things like social grants and grants for the elderly by more than inflation, which they hope will go some way to mitigate the increased costs of, of the VAT increase, which will affect all areas of consumption, as we said, but having said that, I think it's still a fairly narrow spectrum of sort of zero rated goods. I mean, I think there are some canned vegetables, there are some meat products, and there are some dairy blends, which things that get a mention in the document. And I think, but even if we included those things, it's still quite a narrow range of things that are zero rated. So it will be felt, but one can only hope that for the more impoverished, areas of society, that the increases in the welfare grants, the SRD, the relief of distress grants, which have been increased by more than inflation, will somehow help to combat these effects, right?
Reeza, obviously a good barometer of measurement, I guess, is always the RAND. Closed last night at 18.21, now 18.39, so almost 1% weaker on the night. That's a good indicator, isn't it?
I think that is. I think the you know, if I look at the area that I work in, almost specialize in the bond markets, African bond market and the currency markets, those are often the first indicators or the first of the financial variables that do react to the budget. And I must say that the reaction has been somewhat range bound, right? So we haven't seen a massive sell-offs in the currency, a little bit of weakness, but we haven't seen massive sell-offs in the currency or the bond market. And I think that is a little bit of a testament to the fact that I think given the, as I said earlier, the limited amount of levers that the minister has got to pull, I think it's basically an adequate balancing act that is pulled off. There was obviously back initially, but I think, you know, a half a percent over 2 years in VAT is not a bad outcome. There's no adjustment to personal income taxes. There is also no adjustment to the income tax ban. So you have this element of bracket creep. But I mean, if you were to look at the whole and just provide just a, you know, a broad assessment of the budget, I think it's fairly balanced, and I think it's quite sensible. And as such, you haven't seen big swings in the currency or the bond markets. And also, we learned quite early on, this news actually comes out before the speech itself, and with regards to the borrowing tensions and in terms of the size of the weekly bond auctions, we know that a little bit before 2 o'clock it was announced that there would be no changes to those amounts. Now that is consequential because it means that there is no intention on the part of Treasury to increase the number of bonds that get auctioned every week, i.e. we are not issuing more debt. So that is at least one area of relief. And I think that goes again to our general story that the currency and bond markets have been fairly well behaved and have received this budget in a relatively okay fashion.
Reeza, let's look at a couple of other aspects. He did allude to the fact that debt remains high. So I guess we've got to question how sustainable government's current approach to managing it is. And maybe on the upside, infrastructure spending is going to be a major focus. Yes. But I guess the real question is it going to deliver the kind of growth that we're hoping for?
Yes. So let me start right at the tail end there, right? So what we do know is that what is clearly an imperative is to get to a more sustainable, growth footing. I think that if you look over the medium-term expenditure framework, and that's just fancy jargon that they use for basically the next 3 years, then South Africa will struggle, to do well to almost get to just 2% of real growth. Now, that is a very anemic number, and we, of course, most people, you know, if we look at the ratio of debt to GDP, most people look at the ratio and they focus on the debt part, but I think a far more consequential part is to focus on the denominator, i.e. growing the domestic product. So I think it is an imperative to actually get onto a much more sustainable footing with regards to real growth. And I think that picking up from one of the points that you made, infrastructure spending as a means of sort of fixed capital formation actually has got many sort of multiple effects, right? So once you spend on roads and bridges and water and projects such as those things, clean energy, they generally create a lot of jobs, and they create basically alternative sources of energy and power, and they've got a lot of multiplying type of effects in the economy. So that is certainly a way to start getting growth onto a more stable footing. So those initiatives are certainly welcomed. And then, as I said, with regards to the debt is certainly a problem. So if we were just put some numbers on it, we know that ratio I quoted you a little bit earlier on, debt to GDP, that stabilizes at around 76% over the next 3 years. Now, that is quite a high number. I must also mention it is a lot lower than some of our sort of developed world sovereigns like Japan and the United States, for example. But for its emerging market peer set, it is a big number. But what we do know, as I mentioned earlier on, is that there is no intention to increase the base load of debt. You know, there will be no increase to the size of weekly bond auctions, and there's no indication that the nature of how the government funds itself from the bond market is responsible. I mean, that is doing the best with the levers that. And I think that if we can get growth onto a better footing, then even if the current debt stockpile remains as is, or even grows, just nominally over the next three fiscal windows, then with a better growth footing, then that ratio of debt to GDP will start to look a lot better, and that will do well in terms of attracting investor confidence into our capital markets.
Going to thank you for that analysis. Head of Bonds at Prescient, Reeza Ishmael, thank you indeed.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, South African consumers spending a staggering 637 billion rand on FMCG products last year. But despite this very big number, growth, I read, remains sluggish. The latest NIQ State of the Retail Nation report highlighting how consumers are shifting towards private label brands, bulk buying and discounts in response to economic pressure. This is also interesting. Smartphone sales are down, dragging the tech and durable sector into flat growth territory. So what do we read into this? Is it a warning sign for retailers or just a new normal in the way in which we shop? I'm going to talk now to Zach Ayire, who is Managing Director at NIQ South Africa. Let's look at this data and what it tells us maybe about the short to medium term future of retail. So Zach, despite a very strong festive season, retail growth for last year was sluggish. Why isn't consumer spending then keeping up with inflation?
So it's a good question. I think the reality is that we've come from a context of relatively high inflation, and average wages have not really kept up to speed with that. So people have got, on average, less money to go around. There are differences, there's nuances depending on which, you know, LSM we're looking at, for example. But the reality is, yeah, people don't have more money to go around. That has slightly changed of late. So obviously, the amount of money that's being distributed through grants has been increasing in various places. Also, we've got the two-pot pension windfall, which was quite a boon, pumping quite a lot of money back into the consumer pockets. But the reality is, yeah, wages on average haven't been keeping lockstep with inflation. So, you know, something has to give. And what gives is consumers dropping out of categories, focusing on retailers where they might get perceived or actual value back in the form of loyalty points, those sorts of things. So, yeah, consumers will respond. And I think our numbers are indicating the ways in which they're responding.
And shopping more strategically and carefully, I imagine. For instance, and I mentioned this at the start of our conversation, private label brands outperforming the market by around 7% growth. In your opinion, is this a permanent shift in consumer buying habits or maybe just a short-term cost-saving trend?
It's an interesting question, but, you know, when we see habits change, even when the reason for changing that habit is no longer there, like that kind of pressure on the pocket in this case, we always find a proportion of consumers will just stick to the recently adopted habit. And that happens in all sorts of different contexts. So if you kind of force somebody to change, a certain proportion of people will just stick with that change because they've discovered that it works for themselves, you know, gives them value for money. So we think it's here to stay. The penetration of a private label is already quite high in some categories. It's kind of difficult to see it go much higher. I think maybe we will see private label encroach into those categories where maybe they're a little bit less penetrated. But you're absolutely right. It's outperforming the market. That's happening for a... It's not just the price reason, though. I think there's also a brand story there. So in South Africa, we're actually, you know, South African retail is very advanced compared to the rest of the world. And private label execution is no different. So if you look at some of those brands, Jeremy, they're really hard to distinguish from non-private label brands. So I think it's also a branding story as well as a price story on the private label side.
Zach, we all love a good loyalty program, and those as well as promotions continue to drive sales. But there is a red flag here, surely. Could retailers become too dependent on discounts to boost turnover?
This is the perennial question, I'm afraid. And it's both on the retailer and the supplier side. Like, to what extent do we promote? To what extent do we engage in these programs? I would say some of these programs, like these promotional periods, it's almost like a kind of a grudge thing that as a retailer and as a supplier, you almost have to engage to a certain level. It's almost like... you know, a defensive play in some instances, as opposed to an offensive play, because if you're just not present, then maybe the share that you're going to retain post that period of promotion will be considerably lower. So I think it is a very fine balancing act. We are creating like a promotional beast, and unfortunately, you have to keep on feeding those sorts of beasts. So very difficult balancing act. I'll give you an anecdote on the T&D side, on the tech and durables side. Black Friday was a phenomenal Black Friday last year. So units were actually up, which is exactly what we want to see, right? We want to see unit growth, volume growth. That was up 12% year on year. And we think what was going on there is that they were shallower discounts, but on a wider repertoire of products. So look, you can still gain, you can still win big from promotions. And I think it's an extremely risky strategy to not engage with these really important promotional periods at all.
Just a final one, smartphone sales, I also mentioned this at the start of our chat, are down. I think the market shrinking by around 2%. Do you think we might be reaching a point, a saturation point in the adoption of mobile?
That could be a part of the story, definitely. If we look to volumes, though, like how many units are shipping, it's pretty consistent year on year. So, yeah, we have, I think, a slower, cycle time. So consumers are holding onto their phones for longer. Also, the operating systems are kind of like supported for a lot longer than they have been in the past. So that's one reason. The other reason, I think, is there's been an influx of and an expansion of much lower priced smartphones into South Africa. You'll start to see those brands maybe more and more visible, maybe more and more present. And so the average price point for the whole sector has just taken like a level shift down. So consumers are still buying them. I think they're just in many cases trading down. And then also the, tech and innovation really drives the tech and durables industry, and smartphones is no exception. And if you look at the biggest innovation that we've got on that side right now, it's 5G, and those price points, I think, they're just out of reach for a lot of consumers.
And that is a window on how we are spending our money. Zak Khayri, thank you very much indeed, Managing Director, NIQ South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's tech industry is facing something of a paradox. Listen to this. There is a severe shortage of skilled IT professionals in the country. We know that. Yet hiring in the sector has seemingly declined. Employers say they simply can't find the right skills. But at the same time, thousands of young South Africans remain unemployed. As I say, a paradox. At the heart of the problem, a talent pipeline that obviously isn't keeping up with industry needs. I want to explore this in a little more detail with Jessica Hawkey, Managing Director of Red Academy. It's a training provider that's experimenting with a different approach, one that prioritizes skills and work experience over traditional qualifications. I wonder if there's a risk there. Well, Jessica, a very warm welcome. Let me start with the obvious question before we talk about risk and approach. Why, despite such high demand for IT professionals in the country, are companies still struggling to find the right talent?
Thank you, Jeremy. I think from what we've seen in the market at the moment, it is that mismatch between the skills that are available and the skills that are traditionally being trained for and those that the companies need at the moment.
So if we have this serious digital skills crisis and hiring in IT is in decline, what, in your opinion, is wrong within the talent pipeline?
From our perspective, and maybe it's to touch on a point of what Red Academy does and the way in which we train candidates and bring youth into roles in technology, we've coined a phrase being skills integration as a service. And this goes beyond just that traditional training. It takes theory into account, yes, that customized theory is always needed, but then integrates that work readiness and that work experience and integrating this inside the live environment throughout. And as a service, doing that for our customers through our proven methodology. And we have found that to date, it has been tremendously successful with 96% of our graduates going into employment the day after finishing the program. And I think in this country and this economy, we need to be measuring the number of roles created. If we look to various surveys that are out there, it says that 65% of companies are finding it difficult to find talent with the right skill sets. So we need to be sure as a country and an economy that we are matching those skill sets to what companies need.
There is a bit of risk attached to it, though, because on the one hand, I understand the integrative approach, that's critical, but so many companies require experience before they will give people a job. It's a kind of the chicken and the egg situation. How do you overcome the skepticism from companies in that respect?
I think that the companies are valid in that skepticism. I think that workplace and work experience is tremendously valuable. It is something that we need to equip the youth with. And that's why in our program, we spend 6 months delivering live client projects into the business. This means that our candidates have the experience for the exact roles that they will be entering beyond the program. They can speak from a place of confidence, a place of having delivered into that client's business prior to their final interviews. And this is all overseen by Red Academy and that approach. But we have found that bringing youth into the workplace and then overseeing that client delivery is absolutely important, combining that with the theory, but incorporating that element of that workplace experience and delivery on projects.
And back to the theory very quickly, Jessica, all of this works well, providing the initial foundation education is solid.
Yes, correct. At Red Academy, we take South African matriculant youth into the program. Those who may not have studied software development or technology skills prior to this, but we seek candidates with that attitude and that aptitude to succeed in careers in technology and training them on our clients' exact needs. We undertake a discovery phase with our clients to understand what technology stack, what operational processes they use, and then customizing the skill sets to ensure that businesses are equipped with those exact skills that they need for those roles.
And Jessica, how would you respond to the argument that a degree provides critical thinking skills beyond just technical ability? I guess the question is, can skills-based programs actually replace that?
Truly, degrees are definitely valid, and they're definitely needed in certain sectors. I think that they absolutely have a place, but with the rate at which technology is changing, I think it is exceptionally important to, yes, incorporate that critical thinking that you've mentioned, but incorporate it into the exacting needs of industry, of clients, and of the roles available in the country to ensure that we are matching the youth to those in-demand skill sets that they do need. When it comes to technology and the rate of change, adapting your programs, adapting that thinking, adapting the approach to what companies need, and ensuring that candidates have the experience in doing so is exceptionally important.
And you've preempted my next question. Technology, as we know, moves fast and often quicker, I imagine, than traditional education can adapt to. So obviously time to completely rethink how we train IT professionals. What happens if we start falling behind the curve and we just rely on the tried and tested and the traditional?
At this stage, we're already seeing those effects with the massive skills shortage and the offshoring of what equates to about 10 billion rand of roles in this country to offshore locations. As a country and as an economy, we need to be sure that we are bringing those back, that we are changing our approach, that we are adapting from the traditional methods to ones that answer business and youth needs, you know, for those skill sets to really contribute, to hit the ground running from their first day, building organizations, building the economy, and supporting business.
In your experience, Jessica, we talk about the skills deficit. What specific skills are most required right now?
I think that there is always a place and always a need for the workplace skill sets, those soft skills of operating inside a team, contributing in the environment. But if we look to the technical skills, AI is certainly one that is mentioned all over at the moment. But when we look to our clients and to the market at large, software development comes up number one. There is still the need for data science, test automation engineers, and cybersecurity being another core focus and core need of South African organizations.
And just a quick one, this growing debate about South African companies hiring locally or looking abroad for tech talent. Obviously, local is better, but unless that gap is plugged, as you've outlined to me, we're not going to guarantee that homegrown professionals are competitive.
Yes, no, we do need to be plugging that gap. We do need to start with those junior roles, start with that pipeline and build up the skill sets, where it is definitely a role in an area in which candidates can grow in rank and responsibility. It might not be an overnight, but I truly believe it is one that this country can solve with starting with that junior talent pipeline onshore and growing it from there. Yeah. It is far, far better than relying on an offshore market for our skill sets.
Well, certainly a food for thought in a changing economy. Jessica Hawkey, thank you very much indeed. Managing Director at Red Academy. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa, like much of the world, is facing a growing water crisis fueled by climate change, infrastructure failure, and in some cases, just plain mismanagement. According to a new report, water is dangerously undervalued. That leads to underinvestment and inefficient use. I want to talk about this in a little more detail. I'm joined by Dean Murovan, Associate Director at the Boston Consulting Group. They've just put out a report to discuss how we can rethink water's true value and whether the right pricing strategies could drive investment, improve decision making, and also prevent a crisis if we're not there already. So, Dean, a very warm welcome to you. This crisis that we're talking about has been years in the making. One's got to ask the obvious question, why we haven't acted sooner?
Look, I think water is one of those things that tends to be out of sight, out of mind, right? In South Africa, we're dealing with aging infrastructure as a critical challenge, you know, the maintenance of our infrastructure to deliver it. You know, we see losses just in terms of leakages that can go as high as 50 to 60% in some parts of the country. You've touched on the fact in your introduction that climate change does play a role. But I think it's, you know, one of the key issues, and it's not just a South African issue, is that we failed to place a strategic lens on dealing with the water issue, largely because we've undervalued it and as a result of that mispriced it.
Let's talk about pricing in just a moment. When you refer to putting a strategic lens on the problem, what specifically should we have done or should we be doing?
Well, there are two aspects to this, right? You know, both the public sector and private sector. I think there's a misconception that the water crisis can only be solved by the public sector. It is the ultimate shared resource, which means the solutions to the water crisis have to come across sectors and across stakeholders. That's the first aspect to it. Water tends to be treated in isolation. You know, you'd have it handled by a ministry, but the reality is it's a cross-cutting issue, right? Whether you take all tiers of government and all ministries, you cannot function or economies cannot thrive without water. So it's critical that it becomes the heart of development planning. As we think about growing industry, that water is central to that. But because for most parts, it's almost free to certain sectors, that means you don't necessarily need to place it as a strategic input into your business. And that's got to change in a water-scarce world.
Many, of course, argue that water should be free or at least cheap because it's a basic human right. And the challenge, I guess, is how we balance affordability with availability and sustainability.
And herein lies the challenge with water, right? It relates to that complexity. Now, one of the things we talk about in our new report is that you need to understand its economic value, its social value, because it is a human right, you know, enshrined in our Bill of Rights in South Africa. But there's also an important environmental value. And you've got to take all of those dimensions into account and get to what I like to refer to as a socially equitable price of water, right? We cannot ignore in the South African context that it's not just a simple function of changing the price. That needs to be done in a socially equitable manner to ensure that those who don't have water have access to this basic human right enshrined in our constitution. So that is critical. What we do see, though, is when you begin to value water correctly, it does allow you to send the right kind of market signals out there to attract that private investment, right? And someone can afford to pay for water. There are many sectors that are thriving on developing in a water-scarce country like our own, right? We receive about half the world's average rainfall. So somebody can afford to pay. It's about working out who can and how do we adjust that pricing dynamically. And in today's age, this is where tools like AI and tech have a vital role to play in dealing with those, bringing us solutions to the challenge.
South Africa, and I think this is common cause, has one of, if not the highest rate of water loss due to infrastructure failure, in other words, leaks. Wouldn't it be better to fix the system before pricing reform?
Absolutely, right? You know, there's probably here a hierarchy in terms of what needs to be done to address this problem tactically. And I think one of the most critical things that we need to do is a lot of emphasis being placed on the next phase of the Lesotho Highlands project. But we cannot bring clean, more expensive water into a broken system. right? At the most basic level, we need to address those infrastructure issues that need to be addressed within municipalities and reduce those non-revenue water losses. But also along, you know, what needs to go along with that is some degree of behavioral change, right? You know, we consume water definitely not along the lines of being a water scarce country. And that needs to change and you know, brings us back to this question of how we begin to value water across all pillars of society.
So just a final one then, against the backdrop of it all being socially equitable, I think those were your words, you've got the water value framework that your company has put out. How would it change water pricing then in real terms? What would the data look like?
One of the things we outline as part of this report, particularly when you are starting to think about what pricing reform might look like, right? There's the total value of water, which typically most of us would understand. It's the overall value that kind of is measured in rands and cents in terms of how water contributes to economies, ecosystems, and society. But what we also outline, and this is probably more helpful to the public sector, is the marginal value of water. Trying to think about, well, what is the cost of inaction? You know, if I fail to address the leaks in Johannesburg, right? Or weighing that up against installing a desalination unit on our coastline. So that marginal value of water starts to put in perspective this future outlook, right? You know, we don't set and it's never a one-size-fits-all in terms of pricing regime. You do need to take that local context because water can be hyper-local. And one of the suggestions we make is looking at dynamic pricing based on what the system actually needs and what the local economies of scale are actually doing. And that's probably a great way to look at the problem, and combining that with AI, and we've seen this through some of our work across Southeast Asia, it does allow you to look at variable pricing schemes and look at dealing with socially equitable pricing.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dean Mudavan, Associate Director at the Boston Consulting Group. And that's MoneyWeb at midday for today, live at noon and then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.